Today's program is brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest. Hi, welcome to Pizza Talk. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and we've got a really special episode today. I'm excited about this. I'm here with Lisa Pollock and David. I always want to call you David because that's how it's spelled, but it's David Garcia Aguirre at and you're both coming to us from the Corto Olive Oil universe. David, I think you're out in Lodi, and Lisa, you're somewhere in California, right? In Sacramento somewhere.
Exactly.
And we're going to learn, we're going to spend this whole session learning everything we can about not only olive oil, but sort of like the future of olive oil. I think this is the most exciting part to me is that you guys at Corto are doing something that is really unique and special and in a way revolutionary. And so I'm looking forward to hearing all about it. And so let me first welcome you guys. Lisa, it's good to see you.
Thank you for inviting us on here. This is super
a couple weeks ago, you took me through kind of a tasting experience with you sent me one of these little tasting boxes and a kit with olive oils and kind of gave me an initiation, I would say. And it was so illuminating that I felt like it would be great to share this with all of our viewers. And then you invited David to join us. I'll keep going back and forth between David and David, but we got David here and he's going to take us. David, why don't you introduce yourself and what you do? Are you like the operations manager there or what?
Yeah. So my name is David Garcia Aguirre. I'm the master miller here at Corto Olive. And what that really means is that I'm in charge of all of the oil production. And really my job, you know, doesn't really end until all of our customers have received the fresh, you know, high quality oil that we've made. So I'm pretty much the steward of the oil, the crafter, the maker.
Sorry, my phone just went off. I thought I turned off all my phones. This is the Zoom world that we live in.
Hey, we're used to it. Yeah. Working with technology, there's always variables, right? We're all very forgiving. If 2020 has taught us anything.
We've been learning and it's kind of like it's changed our whole perspective on life is that everything, it doesn't always have to be perfect. And it can still be very interesting. In fact, even more interesting. So as Master Miller, that's a term that we think of, in my world, in the bread world, we think of Master Millers with milling grain, and you're milling olives to create olive oil, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, essentially, you know, the term comes from old Spanish and Italian, maestro molinero. You know, it's a different process, obviously, to milling grain. Essentially what I do is I make fruit juice. Instead of keeping the water phase, we keep the oil. And I guess I'm a master juice maker.
We always think of olive oils as being pressed. Is pressing and milling the same thing?
Pressing is an interesting one. So technically speaking, presses haven't been used in 30 years in olive oil. We use centrifuges now to separate the oil from the rest of the olives. And for good reason, the quality is a lot higher. There's no exposure to oxygen. We get a lot more aromatics and more polyphenols, and the oils are just a much higher quality when using centrifuges.
So this is really the difference in a sense between old school and modern times is that the technology's changed, and it's not a bad thing. Technology has actually brought us a higher quality product.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, we don't use donkeys on stones anymore. You know, we have more modern ways of making the product, and it's resulting in
more feet pounding the grapes down in the juice, right? Are you standing like in the mill right now? And are those vats of olive oil behind you?
Yeah, so I'm actually in our cellar, and all of these are stainless steel casks, and they're all full of olive oil from this year's harvest.
Wow, how many gallons would you say of olive oil is the typical harvest, or as was this year's harvest?
You know, it depends. So olives are alternate bearing. So they'll have an on year and an off year. But, you know, suffice it to say, we've got, you know, oh, what now? Over 80 of these casks.
Wow.
We've got plenty of oil.
And Court, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time today talking about the Corto company, except that I think it's important for our viewers, especially many of them who are in the pizza world, to know that Corto is a term that's connected to the name Corto Pasi, which and Corto Pasi family are the family behind Stanislaus tomatoes. So you guys are both in the olive oil business and the tomato business. I'm guessing the tomato business came first, right?
It did. Actually, you know, I will spend a little time talking about the family because I think it paints a good backdrop as for what's happening in the olive oil industry. So, you know, Corto obviously is was founded by the Corto Pasi family about 15 years ago. And the Corto Pasis are a multi-generational farming family. It came from Lucca, Italy. I think Amerigo came over in the 20s. And his son, Dino Corto Pasi, is really the enigma and the driving force behind the success that Stanislaus Food Products has had and now Corto is having. And really what set Dino apart was, you know, many things, but two in particular, I think, that are pretty relevant now. You know, number one, Dino has always believed that, you know, in order to have a successful company, you have to have a demonstrably better product. And that means that take whatever else is out there, you know, whether it's tomatoes, whether it's olive oil, and your product has to be better. Because at the end of the day, people continue, they'll keep coming back to the high quality products. And the other part of that is Dino was always willing, even more than willing, he was always eager to find innovations, you know, innovative ways that not only make you more efficient, but also continue to widen that gap in quality. And, you know, in tomatoes, that was, you know, an example would be like he was one of the first adopters of the tomato harvester, the automated tomato harvester. And obviously, when it first started, it wasn't perfect. You know, there were a lot of challenges. But at the end of the day, you realize that not only can you get a lot more tomatoes out of the ground, you can also get them to the cannery faster. So the overall quality is a lot better. And he saw the exact same opportunity here with olive oil and this new method of planting, which we'll get into, which is really revolutionizing the olive oil industry. It's the first time, I like to say it's the first time in olive oil history that we're able to get fresh, high quality fall harvested oils into the marketplace at any kind of scale.
Yeah, I think what's exciting is I think a lot of people who are watching, maybe like I was when I first, you know, kind of started talking with you guys, thinking of olive groves as being these tall trees with, you know, branches drooping down, loaded with dark olives, you know, purple olives that are ready to fall off and be harvested. And that is like maybe the way it was a couple hundred years ago, but it's not the way it is now. And now we've got a whole new, this looks almost like a vineyard is what I'm saying. It's like a vineyard olive groves. And they look more like bushes than like trees. So I know you're going to explain all this to me, and I'm glad that we have this visual up here that people can see. But going back to what you were saying about the business and the family, the ethos of this company really is, it's all about trying to deliver highest quality, it sounds like, is really what's driving the vision of the company.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. You know, and I keep saying demonstrable difference because those are Dino's words, but it really is. It's a push to always deliver the highest quality that's available in the marketplace. And as you see here, or as you alluded to, these vineyard style of planting is giving us not just Corto, it's giving the olive oil industry a huge competitive advantage in that we're able to produce high quality oils now that were never available before.
And this is the crux of the whole thing is why is this a better quality oil? And it has totally to do with when those olives are picked and how and the shape that they're in when they're picked, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I like to start with a story. And it's you can pick your favorite fruit. You know, you can use a peach, you can use an orange, but we'll use an orange for this one. So, you know, imagine an orange in your backyard and you have an orange tree in your backyard and it's you go through the harvest season and you watch that orange grow from a little orange to the point when it's at that perfect moment of ripening, right? And you go out there and you pull that orange off the tree and you juice that orange. That orange juice is going to be amazing, right?
Especially when it's tree ripened. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you're pulling it straight off the tree at the perfect time, and you can, that juice is going to be amazing. Or if it's a peach and you bite into that peach, it's going to be incredible. Now you can let that orange hang on the tree for another 3, 4, 5 months. And that orange is going to continue on its ripening process, right? For all the geeks out there, all the enzymes start breaking the orange down. Eventually those enzymes start, you know, it starts undergoing fermentations, and that orange starts turning black, and then it starts to essentially rot on the tree. And at that moment when it's about to drop, you can still pick that orange and make juice out of it, right? But that orange juice, you can imagine what it would taste like. And unfortunately for all of us that love food, the vast majority of olive oil that's available in the United States comes from fruit that's way overripe like that orange.
Exactly. So overripeness is as big a problem as underripeness.
That's correct. In fruit.
I mean, I had a peach tree in my backyard when I first moved to North Carolina. It was one peach tree, and I loved that tree until a landscaper one day inadvertently, you know, ruined it and cut it down. But it gave me maybe 12 peaches a year, and I just wanted to wait till the perfect moment to pick it. And it was a different kind of peach when you picked it that way than if you picked it early or if you waited too long.
Yeah, and that's right. And that time in olives is in the fall. It's in October and November. The antioxidant levels are the highest in the fall. The aromas and the flavors that you get are all reminiscent of fresh green, fruits and herbs and things like that. And the reality is all premium oils are harvested in the fall. The challenge has always been there hasn't been until now a way to harvest the fruit in a way that we can get enough olives off the tree to make enough oil to meet the demand for high quality oil.
And those of you who are not actually seeing what we're doing, but listening to it as a podcast, aren't seeing what I'm seeing on the screen, which is a graphic that has maybe seven, an olive at seven different stages of its growth. And prior to that, we were looking at the what would you call it? The vineyard, so to speak, or the orchard in which these olive groves were planted, which were row after row, straight long rows, of olive. Are they trees? David, are these trees?
Yeah, they're trees. They're trees, and they're just planted in basically in hedgerows on trellises, just like we plant wine grapes.
Hedgerows, I guess that's the word I was looking for. So, and acre after acre after acre of these, but then the olives themselves. I'm looking at a photo now where there's an olive that's very bright green. It's sort of, I would say my first impression would be it's not ripe, it's not ready. Then there's one that's starting to get a little bit of color, and then there's one that's more, some more purples coming in, one that's almost, you know, mostly purple. Then there's one that's all purple, and then it's going to black, and then finally at the end it's wrinkled like a prune. So those are like different stages. Where are olives usually picked, sort of in the old school, and where are you picking?
So the vast majority of olives, more than 70%, probably even closer to 80%, are harvested after January, which would put it at the last two ripening stages in the graphic. So, you know, the reality is October, November, maybe the first few weeks of December are the ideal point to harvest olives. That's when, like I said, the antioxidant levels are the highest, when you make premium oils. When you start getting beyond that, you start losing the antioxidants drop off quickly, the fermentation starts, so you can actually start getting defects in the oil. And you get to a point eventually where you can't even make extra virgin oil from those olives.
So the olive that the graphic says is the time when you pick them is the second olive on this lineage. The first one's very bright green. This one is just starting to show a little bit of color. And then the next one after that gets more colorful. So it's the one that's just getting color. That's when you grab them.
Yeah, we like to say it's green to violet.
and in the graphic, it also says that when most, you know, old school companies harvest, it's when the olive is much more purple or dark purple almost. And I guess that's because it's easier to get them off the trees, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, actually, do you mind if I take a step back and kind of explain what makes olive oil different and why this is important?
Yeah, absolutely.
because I think the context and the backdrop here is really important. Because I think the problem is olive oil traditionally has been lumped into the edible oil category. It's been treated like a fat. And if we continue to use that kind of framework to contextualize what olive oil actually is, we're never really going to understand and appreciate what high quality olive oil is. And, you know, olive oil, what makes it different than everything else is that olive oil is essentially a juiced fruit, right? Every other kind of oil out there, I don't care if it's soybean, canola, grapeseed, nut oils, whatever it is, it goes through a refining process. And the refining process strips away any flavor, any aroma, any color, and it just ends up as a colorless, odorless fat, basically.
Yeah.
Olive oil is the exact opposite of that. So olive oil is actually a celebration of the fruit itself. So, you know, the better the fruit, the better the quality of the oil. And, you know, and we'll talk more about storing oil and the freshness of the oil, because that's the other part of this equation. But for right now, we have to understand that olive oil is juiced fruit. And that's what makes it special.
How much of the oil is in the fruit part and how much is in the seed? Or is there, you know, an issue there in terms of the quality?
No, almost all of the oil is in the fruit. It's in the flesh. Hmm. There's very little in the pit itself.
Okay. So as opposed, and how much of that is juice versus oil?
Oh, good question. So it's about, I'd say an olive's about 18-20% oil and about 50% water.
And does that water have to get somehow dealt with? It doesn't go into the final product, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's what the centrifuges, or the old days, it used to be the presses. The presses would press out the water and the oil, and then you'd let it settle and they'd naturally separate. Today, we use centrifuges that separate the water and the oil.
So that way the oil goes straight into its own tank. And what happens to the juices?
Well, currently, so once the oil is extracted, once the oil is pulled out, it's called pomace. And currently, at least in California, the pomace is mostly going to compost, animal feed, but there's a lot of untapped value in the pomace. And you know, it's such a new industry, the world of high quality oil at scale, that we're just starting to scratch the surface there.
I know that people are doing the same thing with grapeseed pomace. And grape pumice, and finding other uses, both pharmacologically, cosmetically, all sorts of other benefits, because those antioxidants are still in the pumice too, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, we always talk about the antioxidants in the oil, and the oil does have antioxidants, but the vast majority of antioxidants are in the water.
Ah, that's interesting. So yeah, so we've got two distinct products then. Well, you know, this is pretty fascinating stuff, because again, we take it for granted. We use olive oil. We use any kind of oil. We don't really think about where it comes from. We just know that we like this one better than that one. We know that maybe, well, we should talk a little bit, maybe in a bit, about the type of olives themselves and what factor that has in the flavor. But because ultimately what you're talking about is delivering a highest quality flavor components to this functional food, which is oil.
Yeah, I think that's what's so exciting. We like to say around here that olive oil is the ingredient that farm to table forgot.
Interesting.
Right? Because you can go to any restaurant and they can tell you about every ingredient on that menu, right? They'll tell you about the proteins, the microherbs, whatever it is they're using. And then you ask them about the oils and they don't have a clue. You just get this like look on your face, like, wow, I have no idea. I've never even thought about that.
Right.
And so our big thing is we want to close the loop on that, because olive oil touches more ingredients in a dish than almost any other ingredient in there. Uh-huh. And yet we don't pay it the service and we don't use it in the right way yet. And I think once we can start conceptualizing it as, you know, a juice that retains all the flavors and aromas and everything from the fruit, and then we can start talking about different varietals and things, that opens a whole new world for chefs and for, you know, artisan homemaker chefs. And it basically, you know, it's a new tool that we're just starting to scratch the surface with.
And we can get as specific with that as we can with grapes and with cheeses and things like that.
Exactly.
Yep. The nuance factor comes in. Well, listen, why don't we do this? Let's take a little break right now, because I have a lot more questions I want to ask you, and I want to learn as much as I can from Wally. And well, maybe we'll bring in the next segment, we'll bring Lisa back in And we'll talk about not only the farming techniques, but these flavor components. And then, of course, ultimately, I want Lisa to kind of walk me through a tasting, for the benefit of everybody who's watching, so we can actually, you know, get those flavors in our mouth and describe them and talk about them. So, David, we'll and all of you, hang in there for a second. Come back for the next part. We're going to continue on this. I will call it our primer, our primer of olive oil. Everything you want to know about olive oil, and we're going to continue the discussion in just a moment. Thanks. We'll be right back with more Pizza Quest right after this break.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth has made specialty cheese in the rolling hills of Wisconsin for more than 30 years. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style Grand Cru cheeses. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sir Choix was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Welcome back. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and I'm here with Lisa Pollack and David Garcia-Aguirre from Corto Olive Oil. And we're going to continue because we've had a fascinating sort of first round on this, and it just got my wheels spinning. I've had so many questions for you guys. David's been giving us sort of a crash course in the process of milling as opposed to pressing olive oil. And in a sense, these are examples of the different understandings that we have of what olive oil actually is. So David, you were talking about the fact that olive oil really is the juice from a fruit. Is an olive a fruit when you say it's a fruit?
Yeah, no, that's a good place to start. So olives are fruit. Surprise, you know, a lot of us never really conceived of it in that way. But yeah, so olives are a fruit. And, technically speaking, olive oil isn't juice, I guess, because juices are, you know, water. But for a context for how to think about olive oil, it works perfectly.
You know, we're essentially separating the juice from the oil afterwards, but it's juiced from the olive, so to speak.
And
how do you do that juicing? What's the process of you said it's not being pressed the way we used to think of, like I think of making apple cider, you know, or apple juice, you know, from by pressing apples and squeezing out the juice. But this is different. How do you do it?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a relatively simple process. All we do is we harvest the fruit, we rush it to the mill as fast as possible because the time between milling and harvest is a big factor in quality. Then we crush the olives whole. So we pit and everything. We crush them into a paste, kind of like a tapenade. And then we slowly mix that paste for about 20 to 30 minutes. And that allows all the oil droplets to come together. And then we send it into a centrifuge. And that centrifuge separates the oil from everything else. And at that moment, you have the freshest oil possible.
So you crush it. Now, how do you do the crushing? What crushes the olives?
There are different methods. Typically, you know, most mills use what's called a hammer mill or a blade crusher. And they literally, you know, they're like little hammers that are cutting it down into small bits.
So, my analogy for this is always the bread world and the grain world. So hammer milling is an actual type of milling that's used right. Yep. In bread making and in flour production too. So, but to get the olives, so you've got olives growing in these incredible orchards of olive trees that have been sort of cut to, I don't know, I think of it as like these little Japanese trees, you know, so to speak, because you're keeping them small.
That's true.
And they're growing, the fruit's growing all over the plant, right? And all on the new growth, whatever new growth from this year, that's where the fruit's going to happen. And then how do you get them off the vines?
So the olives grow on last year's wood. So every, you know, we're like a year behind with the fruit. So they're grown in hedgerows on trellises and they're really close together. They're like 3.5 feet apart, the trees are. and they grow into each other to form a hedge. Basically, what we've done, what the innovation was, and I shouldn't say we didn't invent it, but we have adopted it. What has happened is we've taken a grape harvester, same exact concept, but we've made it bigger. So the harvester will drive over the top of the row, and inside there are little gentle picking fingers, we call them, but they shake back and forth and they strip the fruit off of the tree.
It's amazing.
And then that fruit goes cleaned up.
You're able to get them off the tree at an earlier stage than old school, because the yep. method itself gets them, you're not just shaking the tree, you're actually kind of separating the fruit from the branches. And Lisa, you had, I think, mentioned something about, again, this sort of difference, this different approach from, I'll just call it new school versus old school. When did all this sort of change? When did the paradigm flip?
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, so when we're talking about kind of this new planting style, you can kind of think about it as like, this is something that's taken off in California as like the new world, where it's kind of like, we now have a way to mechanically harvest this fruit in the fall. Because the biggest difference is that when we were talking in the last segment about like, you know, the scale of the life cycle of how that fruit kind of develops and its flavor and eventually becomes overripe, where you get the best quality out of the olive fruit that translates into the oil is when you harvest that fruit in the fall, when it's green and kind of just starting to turn to like this blush violet. And yeah. So the harvesting at that point is a little bit more complicated because it takes more force to remove the fruit from the actual tree. And so like in these old world producing regions, generally the trees are planted traditional style. So it's, you know, 15 to 20 feet in between each of these individual kind of larger trees.
And they're not cut in edges, but they grow up like trees.
Yeah. Exactly. And so it's possible to make a fall harvest olive oil that way, but you're going through and you're harvesting the fruit by hand or just using like these rakes and things. So it's a slow and it's laborious process. So those fall harvest olive oils kind of coming from these traditional groves are much more limited in production. And so why it's so exciting to kind of have a way using these hedgerows is that like now we have this machine that helps to assist that process of pulling them off the tree in the fall. So it's a lot faster and a lot more efficient. So what's kind of happened is that if you wait to harvest the olives until they're, you know, much more ripe, then this abscission layer kind of breaks down and it's a lot easier to remove that olive from the tree once it turns black and kind of starts that decomposition. And so what's happened is that, you know, in order to get through all the trees and for kind of an ease of harvest, if you wait till much later in the season, then it's possible to just kind of shake the trunk of those trees and the olives fall off. The trade-off is you lose the flavor, right? Because if you think about those olives, thinking back to kind of the peach or the orange analogy, you know, we can still bite into that peach when it's ready to fall off the tree, right, and kind of overripe, but you're going to get all these kind of funky fermentations and flavors and things. And that's exactly what happens with
the olives. It's a little counterintuitive for us when we use those fruit analogies, because we like to think of ripening them to the peak of sugar development. Whereas in this case, we're taking them early, pre-sugar. We're taking them when the flavor of the olive itself is at its peak, of the oils in that olive is at its peak. And that's earlier in the growing cycle. And by the way, earlier you had provided us with some great graphics of seeing the hedgerows and seeing, you know, even the plants and the mills. But for people who are not able to watch this, people can access this on your website, right? You've got a lot of great videos and photos there where they can see the things we're talking about, right? How can they get to the website? Yeah. What's the best way for them to get to the website?
So if you just go to, it's Corto, CORTO-olive.com. And then on the landing page, you'll see, you know, check out our fall harvest. And we have a new portal with videos. You can really walk through and see all of this process in action, which is really cool. So I encourage everyone to kind of check that out.
Great. Now, and this is for both you and David, is that the olives that are growing in those hedgerows, you must have made a conscious choice, or the Corto Posse family, somebody, you know, made a choice of which olives to plant. And, you know, a lot of, I think, we think in the artisan world, and if you, again, grape analogies, there's varietals. Are your olives a particular varietal, or are they a blend of different kinds of olives? Or, and how were those choices made?
Yeah, so we typically in this method of planting, the three dominant varietals are Arbequina, Arbasana, they're two Spanish varietals, and a Greek varietal called Koroniki. And the reason they were chosen is because they're low vigor varieties. So if you imagine in a hedgerow, you don't want the trees to get massive. So those three varieties lend themselves well to this planting method. Now that said, there are about another 10 varietals that are being developed and tested for this method of planting. So, you know, it's a new method. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more different varietals coming into play.
That should get real interesting in the future as we get specific and blended and all these other, I mean, I imagine blending will become a big thing in its own right. This method that you're using at Corto, you didn't invent it. Where else in the world is this being used, and where was it pioneered?
So it was pioneered. So it's being pioneered around the world. So it was invented in Spain. It wasn't adopted readily early on in Spain. It was mostly adopted in California, Australia, South Africa. Chile is a big adopter. And now is being planted extensively in Spain and Portugal. I think the writing's on the wall. Everyone sees that this is the future of olive oil. So we're starting to see a lot more of this planting happening around the world.
And I would imagine because it's so intensively planted that the yields per acre must be much higher than the old school method.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we had one of our family growers once made a comment that really stuck with me. And he said, you know, in agriculture, it's rare that you have an opportunity that makes yields and quality better. And when you have that opportunity, you have to go all in. And I think this is one of those opportunities.
This is really because it's very counterintuitive. Olives are very different from grapes or from wheat.
Yep.
I was just going to add something that's like the most exciting part about this is like what it's really opened up is that it's opened up a way that we have fresh olive oil more available right now. Cause it's like, you know, for me, like I grew up on olive oil that now I recognize was not fresh at all. And this concept of fresh olive oil was super foreign to me. Like I even kind of how I fell into the industry was working on a farm where we're harvesting the olives, which like first that was a learning because I didn't even know olives grew on trees. Then we take them into a mill and it's like, you know, there's all this buildup to taste this olive oil. I tasted it and the first sip, you know, it was peppery. It was kind of bitter. I was just confused because it was unlike any olive oil I'd ever tasted, you know? And so I think that's the most exciting part is just that like it's raising the bar because now we have more of this fresh olive oil available. Right. So it's changing chefs and home chefs, you know, changing our palates to appreciate this flavor and really kind of integrate it into the food, which is the most exciting part.
Well, it is, but I want to go back to this facet of being able to grow more intensively and yet, and what sounds like in a more sustainable manner. What are the benefits of this method in terms of the earth itself, you know, and because usually when you think of intensive growing, you think about depleting the soil and you think about, you know, like, you know, sucking up tons of water. You know, what are some of the other differences in this method and in olives that differentiate it from all the other kind of farming that we associate with?
Yeah, and a great question. You know, I think from the outset, when we saw this method of planting, we weren't thinking, you know, Corto is going to be big. We were thinking we can establish a long-term California industry. And sustainability is a big part of that. You know, right now in California, we have over 1 million acres of almonds planted. And olives use, you know, less than half of the water. And I think that's being generous to almonds that almonds do. They use less water than grapes even. The other really interesting thing about olives is they're evergreens, right? So they have leaves on them year round. So olives actually are a carbon sink. The IOC, which is the International Olive Oil Council, released a study a couple years ago where they found that, you know, for every 2 acres of olives that are planted, and they were looking at traditional, with intensive, it's even better. You know, for every 2 acres that are planted, you're essentially absorbing, you know, one person's carbon footprint per a year.
Interesting.
So so long-term, I think it's a great crop for California and for other parts of the world that can grow it.
Are olives dependent on bee pollination?
They're not. They're self-pollinating. But you know what's interesting is because we're not harvesting on the ground anymore, we're harvesting, you know, off the trees, we can actually grow native cover crops. And that will help a lot of the native insect populations, you know, stabilize them and regenerate native insect populations.
You're building the soil up at the same time that you're continuing to grow these hedges.
Yep.
See, I find that to be really fascinating. And must for you guys, it must be very exciting to be to feel like you're part of something that, as ancient as this is and traditional as it is, it's also like it's new world stuff.
That's a great way to put it. I think, you know, we've seen waves in other food products, right? We always talk about like the third wave in coffee, where we went from like a commodity product to like, you know, your Starbucks. And then all of a sudden you have all these really awesome boutique light roast producers everywhere, or beer when we went from macro to micro, you know? And I think we feel like we're at the cusp of that kind of movement.
And yeah, I think the coffee analogy may be much better than the fruit analogy that we talked about earlier because it's so similar. You mentioned that California is one area where it's happening. Are there other companies now that are getting into the game and doing it the way that you're doing it? What land are they using for that? Are they repurposing things that were formerly used for apples or vineyards or almonds or what?
Yeah, so there are certainly, you know, there are probably, you know, 3 to 5, you know, larger companies in California. And I got to say larger in quotations because we're still a teeny tiny industry. So compared to other industries, we're all small boutique producers. But there are other producers adopting the method. And most of the lands are being converted from, they're either in low water use areas. You know, California has it. We have a big water challenge. And so a lot of the acreage that used to be dedicated to other crops like almonds that are higher water users are being converted over, and some new acreage, but most of it's been conversion thus far.
You mentioned some of the different varieties of olives too. Which olives are you growing? Which specific ones have you chosen?
So we have a Arbequina, Arbezzana, Coroniki, and then we have a couple trial varietals like Oleana, Lechiana, Chiquita.
But these are all growing together, or do you grow them separately and then blend them later?
We typically grow them separately and blend them later.
But do they grow similarly? The process is the same regardless of the varietal?
They're grown similarly, but they all require different, they have different requirements. And we're just starting to learn a lot of that. Like we've planted a lot of trees in places that weren't the right place, but that comes with pioneering, I guess.
When I go to buy olive oil, I think of, you know, like there's some that just says olive oil. Some says extra virgin, some says virgin, you know, so there's all these other terminologies. But one varietal that I think it's a varietal is that we use a lot at our house is says Kalamata olive oil. Now, is that an actual olive or is that just a region of Greece is Greek olive oil very different from Spanish olive oil and from Italian olive oil and from American olive oil?
I'm in.
So Kalamata, I believe it's both. I mean, the biggest thing with olive oil is that, you know, when we're talking about flavor, like you're exactly right. Like this idea of what kind of olive you're making the oil from really plays a role because each different kind of olive, and I wanted to give David some credit there because it's part of it's the farming of these different varietals, but a big part of that is the milling process is different kind of varietal to varietal of kind of, you know, the different tweaks that David kind of oversees in the process to bring out the best flavor of that specific variety of fruit. And so, yeah, so these different varietals will have kind of unique characteristics, but kind of before you even get to there, the biggest thing is with olive oil, which this goes back to that fruit idea, is that freshness. It's like you have to make sure that first you have the right flavors of the fruit, and then you can experience the flavors that are coming and the nuances that are coming from the varietal and things. Whereas mm-hmm. like a Kalamata would taste different from, you know, and Arbequina olive oil. And so in part of that, I really say that like the best olive oil is the freshest olive oil because that's where, you know, you're getting 90% of that flavor.
So like,
depending where it's coming from, it's more just about, you know, your means to get that olive oil and how fresh it is when it gets to you. You know, how is it produced, first of all, and then how fresh is it once it gets to you in your kitchen? Yeah. And the best way to know is really to taste. Because a lot of times we look at the label and like you were asking about extra virgin And so extra virgin is a quality standard that's meant to denote that it's the highest quality. And so when we're talking about quality, we're thinking about flavor, but in the United States, it's just a voluntary standard. So just because we see extra virgin on a label, there's no requirement that it's undergoing the testing that needs to be done to verify that. And like the standards defined by the IOC that David mentioned, which has, you know, this two-part testing protocol where it's you're testing part of it in a laboratory, kind of looking at the chemistry of that oil, and part of it is happening with a sensory taste panel. And so since that's kind of unreliable, really the best way to know if we have the best flavor on any olive oil is to taste it, right? Which we're kind of getting
to. We're going to get to, because I'm really, you know, the more we talk about tasting now, the more I'm starting to think about these little vials I have here that I want to try. But just one more thing about that extra virgin. And in our minds, I think we were all conditioned to believe that that meant that you're getting the first pressing and that the regular virgin olive oil is the second pressing. And then there's this, like, the pure olive oil, which is the third pressing. And then there's a pumice pressing. But that doesn't sound like anything like what you guys are doing. All the oils pressed, it's basically crushed once, spun out once. There's no layers of the first, second, third round of these things, right?
Right. Because if you think about it, like if we're thinking about that fruit, and if we're harvesting a fruit when it's way overripe, we could undergo the first pressing of that super overripe fruit. And it's technically a first pressed oil, but that doesn't mean that it's extra virgin if it were to test, if that makes sense, because we have all these other fermentations and flavors.
But you might have been doing pressing right now. I mean, you're grinding.
Oh, yeah, we're not doing that at Cordo, but just to kind of
grinding or a second milling that takes place, is there? Second round milling. It's one.
So for us, no, we're focusing on just extracting, you know, the freshest fall harvest flavor from that green fruit in the fall, right? And it's more kind of in these older, kind of more traditional industries where the second pressing is happening. But just to say that, like, just looking for first pressed on the label, that's not enough, right? Because like this extra virgin idea is meant to kind of filter out to this higher quality, but it doesn't tell us enough that with olive oil, we really just have to rely on our senses and taste it. And we'll kind of talk through what to look for with that.
So what we're going to do now is we're going to be tasting highest quality, which whether you call it extra virgin or not, where it's the equivalent. This is this would be what would, I guess, could arbitrarily be called the extra virgin, you know, best of show kind of, you know, level. So why don't we do this? I'm excited. I think it's time to do some tasting. Unless there's anything else that I forgot to ask you or that you want to add to our conversation here, I think it's time to move into tasting. And what I think we're going to do is sort of take a quick break. I'm going to cleanse my palate. I'm going to get ready. And then I'm going to have Lisa have you guide me through a whole tasting that I will do virtually for everybody else who's watching. And you can sort of, you know, ride along for this. And also mention right here before I forget that those of you who are in the industry, who are in the business, who want to also kind of be guided the way Lisa's going to guide me through, she's willing to send out kits to any of you that want to contact her, right?
Yeah, please do. On our website, we're calling it virtual tasting. And so there's, if you go to that website, it's cordo-olive.com, and scroll to the bottom, you can sign up for a complimentary virtual tasting for chefs and restaurants, which I would love to spend more time and kind of taste more with all of these listeners one-on-one. Yeah.
Well, I think we're in such an early stage of this industry that's only going to get bigger and become more and more important, because we're now kind of competing on the world stage with companies that have dominated olive oil, like Italy and Spain and Greece, that always we associate with oil. And those are all of only the ones we know of. But now we're going to be, as we did with grapes and as we did with cheese and as we did with everything that we do in this continent, because we have such great resources, it's only going to get to be bigger and bigger thing, which means that we need to become more educated as consumers or even if we're in the restaurant business of users of these products, so that we can, you know, continue that education process to our customers. So anyway, it's only going to get bigger. That's why I'm excited about it. And I feel like we're kind of on the ground floor of something that's just, you know, about to
explode. Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's why I feel like I love this industry, because it's, you know, it's unfolding before our eyes and you can really play a part in it, because we're still this small growing industry and we're still trying things, you know? So,
I mean, how can something that's been around for thousands of years be so new? It's just, and I love it.
Yeah.
So let's take a break. I want you all to join us back for the next round. Our final round here is going to be the actual tasting round. And we're going to find out what it is that differentiates the good from the great, and or the fresh from the not so fresh. Stick around for more Pizza Quest after a word from our sponsor.
Good food is worth a thousand words. This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you, My Family Recipe, from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it, from voices across the world of food. Join us as we explore experiences of loss and remembering, accompanied by homemade baked ziti, and chronicles of comfort and celebration paired with the perfect chocolate cake. I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
I think food can serve so many important functions, specifically in grief. It is a way to nourish us, physically nourish us, at a time when we just are feeling so weak and so sad and so maybe incapable of nourishing ourselves.
Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life.
We'd open these tubs of dough and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating, and it smelled like something was happening. You know, there was like a sense of action just in the smell.
I grew up literally hanging off the petticoat tails of three generations of Indian matriarchs who used food to speak their everyday language of love. As a result, I've always reached for the human side of recipes and food traditions. As the editor of the essay series, I work with writers to explore the histories behind these passed down dishes, but also what they mean for the present and our futures. I'm so excited to dig deeper into the stories and voices behind them.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you. That's something that needs to be taught just like any other thing. And the wok seemed like a way of maybe remembering certain things or learning new things, but at my own pace and a rhythm that I could control.
Give us a follow wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen.
All right, now the most exciting part of our gathering with Lisa and David is to taste the olive oil. We've been talking about olive oil. I know a lot more than when we started. I've got a little container of your freshest olive oil that you just sent me overnight. I've got it here. Now I want to know, how do I appreciate it and know the difference between this and everything else I've been eating and assuming was pretty good over the years?
Absolutely. And I mean, that's the biggest thing is we've been talking a lot about, you know, how we make this olive oil, but, you know, let's get to the kitchen and we're using the olive oil with our food and we're using it as an ingredient. And really it's like, well, how do we know if I have the right flavors in my olive oil and kind of what am I looking for? So like in our initial discussions, I'm just going to share a visual real quick here. We were talking about how the olives are actually a fruit. And so I just kind of want to reiterate that. And so I've just popped up on the screen an image of this bowl of these olives, which when we're talking about
grapes, these beautiful green grape-like.
Exactly. Yeah. Olives. They look a little bit different than kind of what we think of when you're picturing like a table olive, right? Because We talked about, you know, the time of harvest of that fruit. Thinking about when we talk about olive oil, we want to think about it as like the juice of this fruit in the sense that, you know, the flavors that we're tasting in any olive oil, they're flavors that are originating in that fruit. Uh-huh. And so when we're thinking about kind of how do we find the best flavor in olive oil, we need to really kind of focus on this idea of the freshness. And the freshness kind of has two components. You know, it starts with that fruit, whereas like when we're talking about getting the best flavor out of an olive, the time of harvest is very important. So we want to harvest the fruit when it's, you know, green, just starting to take on a little hint of violet, which is in the fall for us in California, like October, November. And so kind of with any olive oil, first we want to know that we've captured those fresh flavors from the fruit. So what you're seeing on the screen here is a Venn diagram where we have two circles. So the first circle is this fresh fruit. So that's kind of our first part. Then the other component of this freshness, because when we're talking about freshness, that really is the equation that's lending itself to the flavor and the quality. The other piece is the freshness of the oil itself, because oil, you know, degrades if it's exposed to light, air, or heat. So the storage and kind of how we're protecting that olive oil is kind of the other component. So we need to kind of know if the oil that we're choosing is fresh, meaning that it first kind of captured those fresh flavors of the fruit and it's still fresh because it's been stored and protected. And how do we know if we have that is really by tasting it is the most reliable way to do that. So that's
but when it's not fresh, I mean, the opposite of French fresh would be what, rancid? Would rancid be sort of the other side of the equation that we don't want to go to?
That's exactly right. Like any oil, you know, when we make it, it'll be a fresh oil and we'll also have the fresh flavors if we harvested the fruit at the right time. But if it's not stored properly, I mean, I've done experiments where it's even 24 hours where, you know, I put the olive oil in a clear glass container and I put it up on my roof. You know, I have a lot of time on my hands, but I put it up on the roof, you know, and let it sit in the heat and the sun for 24 hours. Yeah. And it's shocking because, like, you know, over time, the light and the heat will kind of turn an oil rancid, but it can happen really, really quickly. So we're kind of looking for both things.
With wheat, we, you know, with whole wheat, for instance, the, you know, they say you should try to use it while it's still pretty fresh, but certainly not any older than say a month or 2 months, but you have a little bit of buffer time before it kicks over from sort of that sweet, pure oil. And, and when we say that whole wheat's gone rancid, it's because the germ or the oily part of the berry has gone rancid, not the starches and not the bran itself, but the oil. So here we're talking about oil as the dominant thing that we're looking for, as opposed to sugars and right. starches. We're talking about oil. And right. so the rancidity factor here can be very dramatically fast.
It can be very, and I find that rancidity is a very mobilizing word because nobody wants to be using a rancid oil in your food, and especially not in food that you're serving to others, you know? So it's worth kind of, you know, really it all starts with tasting. It's like, that's the thing that we all need to get into the habit of, which was weird to me when I first got into this industry. You know, yeah. I never poured myself a glass of olive oil to, you know, take a sip of it before, but really, like, you just need to kind of get in the habit of tasting your olive oil, and we'll kind of taste together to talk about what we're looking for and how we can really tell if that oil is fresh, because that's where all the flavor lies.
Well, let's start tasting, and I may have some questions along the way, because sure. The first thought that I have in my head is am I ever having fresh olive oil in my home? If I'm getting something off a shelf at a market, it's already older. It's already probably sometimes in a clear bottle. This and that. It's doing all the things that we don't want to be doing. Right. So I've never had freshly pressed olive oil before.
Well, let's see. And let's make sure that I bet you're going to have some right now. All right. So I've sent you ahead, you know, a little bottle of some of our, you know, fresh olive oil, which we've, you know, harvested in the fall.
Yep.
And we're using a cup to taste it. And so we're using, you know, it's a clear cup with a lid. You know, if you're at home or if you're in your kitchen, kind of at your restaurant, you know, you can use whatever's available. A shot glass totally works, a wine glass, you know, these little kind of plastic ramekins work well. And so what we have is a cup so that it fits into the palm of our hand. And then we also have a lid, and there's a reason for that, which you can also kind of just cover it with your hand. But basically, when we're tasting an olive oil, we want to kind of perceive the aromas and the flavor of it. And what we're doing is we're thinking back to that equation of kind of the freshness, and that we really first want to capture those aromas of that fresh fall harvest fruit. So that's kind of what we're looking for first. So when we're going to taste it, I'll swirl this cup in my palm.
While you're doing your swirling, I'm going to do the same thing at home. I'm going to be, you know, matching what you're doing. So I'm swirling it and rubbing it against my palm to bring a little warmth to it.
Exactly. Yeah. What we're doing is we're using our body heat, and that's helping that olive oil to bloom and kind of open up and release more of those aromas, which then that's why we have the lid, or that's why we have our hand, you know, over the top of this cup, is it's keeping those aromas in. So then when we're ready to smell it, we get this burst of that first.
So for those of you who are watching or listening, I'm going to try to share my experience with you so that you know what I'm going through. And then you can contact Lisa so you can go through this directly yourself.
Exactly.
Also, and I mean, some oils at home.
You know, if you're at home, if you're in a kitchen, just grab any olive oil that's handy, you know, and just kind of follow along, and we'll describe what we're looking for. Just see if you're kind of picking up something similar in the oil that you have available.
Okay.
So I'm going to go ahead and smell.
take off the lid and put my nose right in.
And so I'm going to take off the lid and I'm going to hold the cup right up to my nose and I'm going to inhale deeply. And I'm going to think about kind of what I'm smelling here. When I smell this oil, I mean, I'm immediately kind of transmitted outside into like the garden, or it's almost as if I'm kind of walking through those fields, right? Because this is like, when we're talking about that the oil is the juice of the fruit, we're capturing all those aromatics from the fruit. That's what we're smelling here. This is what we'll call like the fruitiness of an olive oil. And it should be something fresh, something green, something vibrant, right? That's like something that would grow in the garden, whether it's kind of grass, herbs, fruits, or vegetables.
Definitely getting green right off the bat and herbaceous and almost, I'm even getting a little peppery.
For sure. And there's kind of like, I really kind of pick up some tomato in this oil that's kind of real fresh, almost like the vine on a tomato. And I mean, like this oil that we're tasting specifically, you know, it's a blend of three of the varietals that we make, you know, so we're picking up little nuances from those different olives.
Yeah.
Any oil to know that it's fresh in general, you just want this bright green burst of that fruitiness kind of coming through initially on the nose when you smell it.
Just as you apply words to these aromas and name them, then it starts to make sense because you smell it. You don't, and this is like what you do with wine tasting as well, is you're looking for the berries or the melon or the this or that. And so, but we don't always have the vocabulary to connect the dots. So what you're doing is connecting those dots. And as you said, tomato, then I went, oh, that's what I just picked up.
Totally. And this is why it's so much more fun to taste. I don't know if you've ever sat at home tasting olive oils or tasting wine and then tasted in a group. It's like, I always appreciate tasting with someone else because it's like half the time you're like, I know what that is, but I can't put my finger on it. And then somebody says, you know, smell it. And
But why, for those who are doing it alone, when you sent me the kit with the oils, you also have a little booklet that helps you to start making notes, and you start to write these things down so that you can create your own, each person can create their own equivalencies, language equivalencies, right. And analogies and associations.
And you can kind of think about it, you know, there's sort of like some descriptors that are commonly found and commonly used, like, you know, maybe green banana, you know, green apple, almond, things like that. But, you know, really like, the world is your oyster, kind of depending on what you eat and depending on what you might kind of recognize in an olive oil. It can really depend. Like part of my background is I used to work with a sensory panel for olive oil, and they were always calling out like notes of green tea in olive oils. I didn't drink any green tea. So it was kind of like, I was always searching for this green tea. It's like, I'm never going to find it until I recognize what green tea kind of has. Green tea,
I do the same thing with wines. I'm always looking for the cherries, the Bing cherry flavor, you know? And it took me a long time to find out where it was and which wines had it.
Right. Because those Bing cherries, you know, they're not always readily available. So kind of back to this oil that we're tasting, kind of the freshness. Yeah. We've got kind of this first burst. That's our first clue that we have a fresh oil. And that's what we want kind of in any olive oil, is that kind of fruitiness right on the nose. So then let's go ahead and taste it. And so
you just said something. Does that mean that if the oil's not so fresh, then I'm going to notice, I'm not going to get that burst of verdancy that I got from this one?
That's right. Yeah. You'll basically find that there's almost no aroma. So it's pretty flat, and that's kind of showing that it, you know, the oil could potentially be old and it's starting to oxidize and starting to turn rancid, or you could kind of pick up some other aromas, which are aromas that translate to something that's, we're not looking for in olive oil, which is the most common thing. Like, you know, in the U.S., we haven't had a traditional source of fresh olive oil. So like largely, you know, what I recognize as olive oil until I kind of fell into this industry was oil that was made from fruit that was much, much overripe by the time it was harvested and made. And so that fruit is rotting and it's fermenting. And so those oils, when you smell them, sometimes it's more of like a briny kind of a black olive, or almost like a harsher kind of chemical acetone sort of kind of aroma. So anything like that is not what we want. And that's
why I said all that, because after we get through this one and I get the gold standard, so to speak, that I brought one from my kitchen in that I want to do the same test to and see how different it is.
Just kind of see what it
is. I know that oil is definitely not new, you know, not fresh.
Right.
Okay, so I haven't gotten to the tasting part though. Should it?
Yeah. So when we're tasting it, so we're actually going to take a sip, but we're also going to suck in air as we're tasting it for a couple reasons. It helps the oil to emulsify on your palate so that we can kind of taste the full flavor. And it's also, as we're doing that, we're also kind of forcing some of those aromas up into our nose as well as our palate, because a lot of these fruitiness and the flavor, we're getting kind of the aromatics and we're getting the texture and the flavor on our tongue.
So it's about the olfactory experience. Exactly. We were talking earlier about that we experience taste and flavor, but 80% olfactory and maybe 20% on the actual tongue itself.
Exactly. So we can go ahead and taste it and pay attention to what you're tasting and also the texture.
Yeah. So I'm slurping. I'm hissing in air, and again, the flavors are changing right in my mouth as I, and in my, not just my mouth, but up in my sinus cavities as I'm breathing it in.
Yeah. And I mean, like, so I'm tasting like even more of that fruit that we kind of were getting that first burst when we smelled the aromas. I'm getting more kind of notes of like a green banana now, you know, it's really kind of coating my tongue. And then do you notice like a little bit of a finish in the back of your throat, Peter?
Yes.
Kind of a little bit of a tickle kind of, and a little bit of a bite.
Yeah.
And so it's like the texture, I just took a sip of olive oil, you know, so it coats my mouth, but we want the oil to know that it's fresh. We want the oil to feel clean after the fact, that it's not kind of sitting and coating the palate, and the finish moves into the back of your throat. And that's kind of where we get a little bit of this peppery sensation. Yeah. And that peppery is kind of something else that we're looking for as an indicator that that olive oil is fresh, because that's coming from these antioxidants that are naturally occurring in those olives. And when we're harvesting those olives early in the fall, kind of when they're at their peak, when they're kind of more green, just starting to turn to violet, that's when the olive has the highest count of those polyphenols. And so that translates naturally into the olive oil, into that kind of peppery sensation, which, you know, the first time I experienced that, I thought something was maybe awry. Yeah.
That never happened to me. I thought, is there something wrong? And I realized that's supposed to be, that's the good sign, you know?
That's a good sign, right? Because once those polyphenols, you know, they make the olive oil super healthy, they also protect, you know, the flavor and the structure of that olive oil. So like if an olive oil is no longer fresh or it's been compromised because it's been sitting open too long, you know, next to a heat source, we'll lose those antioxidants and those will fade and we'll no longer have that peppery kind of sensation. So it's a way that we know also that when we're tasting it, that it's still a fresh oil.
But you're right too, that my mouth still feels clean. The flavor has moved to the back of my palate and to that peppery zone, so to speak. But the rest of my palate feels really kind of refreshed. Like I just almost, just, you know, like, I don't want to compare it to mouthwash, but I like my breath is clean and pure. And
you can use the olive oil as mouthwash. I think that's a great idea.
That could be another thing we could be on there. But no, I think that's that almost like the chlorophyll, the green grassy aspect.
Right. It's kind of mouth invigorating.
It's almost like, yeah, it is like chewing double mint gum.
Exactly. And I mean, that's the biggest thing to remember is like, you know, any oil, like you should be able to perceive the aromas with this kind of fresh fruitiness. The texture should be clean and there'll be some intensity of that pepper, you know, which will vary oil to oil, depending on what oil you're using. You know, we're making a flavor profile that we want to be really fruit forward and kind of versatile in the kitchen, because we work primarily with chefs. So we want to have an oil that can kind of pair with your vegetables and your fish just as much as it can pair with, you know, your meats and things like that. But, you know, this is where, you know, we just want to make sure with any olive oil, we have fresh olive oil as kind of our starting point. And then we can kind of think about all of the nuances and things that, you know, are going to pair into our dish. So, yeah.
So I'm getting all of that freshness. Now I've got this other olive oil that I brought in from my kitchen. I wanted to see from a comparison standpoint, because I think contrast of these things is really helpful. And I know in the kit that you send, you give four different oils so that people can do these tasting, contrasting. We're not going to do all that in this session. And so I'm substituting for some of the other oils you send me. one from my kitchen, which I, and again, I call it, it's labeled as a Kalamata olive oil, whatever that means. And it usually has a bold flavor, and I always like it in food. And so I'm going to do what I did, what you just showed me to do. I'm going to kind of warm it up in my palm, mm-hmm. pick it up a little bit, and see if I can release some of those aromatics, if there's any left.
Totally, we'll find out.
Yeah. I have no idea how long it took that oil to get from Greece to Trader Joe's, from Trader Joe's, how long it sat there before it made it to my shelf. And I'm at the bottom of a bottle, so even if I had just gotten it, it's still probably a few weeks old. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and release the lid now. If I can. Yeah, it's pleasant, but it doesn't blow, you know, like the first time I got this bouquet of, this is, it's shallower. It releases and it goes away. It doesn't
right. have a little that, bit subtler.
Yeah, and it doesn't have the complexity and the depth of the other.
And that could be, you know, like as an olive oil kind of ages, you know, like fresh, we want to start out fresh and we want to keep it fresh, right? Any olive oil will kind of slowly oxidize over time, you know? And so part of that process, if it's partway through and maybe it's not 100% rancid quite yet, you'll notice that those aromatics, as long as they're fruity, you know, we know it was made from a green olive to begin with, but they'll begin to fade before, you know, when an oil fully oxidizes, you're not going to get those aromatics. And then another sense is sometimes we get aromatics that are coming not even from the fruit, from other things.
Right. So even from the best of the olive oil, if it's not as fresh, it's not going to be as good as when it was fresh. But then you've got the other factors that are, when was it harvested? Was it in a sense diminished from the beginning as opposed to maximized?
Right. Right. It's kind of like we need to start fresh and then we need to keep it fresh. Yeah.
I've warmed it up again. I've cleansed my palate with a cracker. I'm going to go ahead and taste it now and see how it's different. Oh, totally different experience. First of all, there's not much complexity of flavor. There's one little burst of flavor. Mm-hmm. It almost feels like it's coating my tongue.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not getting any. Well, I'll give it time. There's a slight bit of the peppery quality that you talked about, but not much. It just feels flatter. I guess that's the best word.
Yeah, I would say that's a great description, as you just lose this dimension. Like, I think of it as like, you want an olive oil to kind of dance in your mouth. You know what I mean? You want to be taken through this ride, you know, where we're smelling it and then we're tasting all these other aspects and then we're finishing with this pepper. Yeah. And as an oil, you know, begins to oxidize, or if it's already rancid, we lose all of those notes and it becomes very flat and it becomes heavier. I mean, the biggest indication if an oil has become rancid is the texture. That's kind of the first indication. And that's, you'll notice is like, you know, when we're talking about a fresh oil is very clean, you know, you're going to taste the opposite if an oil is not fresh. It's going to feel really heavy, like you were describing, kind of greasy, and it lingers. It kind of stays around and you may be starting some of those flavors of rancidity, which stick with you because it kind of has that thicker texture, kind of like waxy crayons or like wet cardboard, or, you know, if we've ever had stale walnuts, those are things that we don't want in an oil that show that it's, you know, it's gone rancid.
Well, fortunately, it's not nearly as vibrant as the first one. It does. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting too many of the negative. I'm getting diminished flavor, but not necessarily what I associate with rancidity, like off flavors or anything that. So maybe it's not this oil. Maybe it wasn't as old, or maybe it was harvested at a better time. I don't know.
Well, one question I'd have is like, so part of what we're looking for is kind of what is the flavor from how it was harvested, but how was it stored? You know, because that's the other big question that we all need to ask. You know,
that's a good question, because it came in a dark green bottle. And so I guess it was protected somewhat from light. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to what David was talking about earlier too, is, you know, sort of the fact that he's got these incredible tanks behind him, or what do you call them? Are they kegs? What's the term that you use? Casks of olive oil, but they look like they're stainless steel, and no light's getting to the oil. Right. And that's what you want. You don't want the light to somehow light will start that oxidation process. Right.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. To give you a quick visual of what they look like. you know, the reality of the situation is, and I don't want to say this because I don't want to make my job sound too easy, but making olive oil when you start with good fruit is the easy part. Honestly, the hardest part at the end of the day is making sure that that as producers, all of us, that we can get fresh oil to our customers. Because, you know, it's one thing when it's here in stainless steel, kept under nitrogen, so there's no oxygen. This is a climate controlled cellar. I can protect the oil here. But once it moves into the real world, you know, all bets are off, right? It could be in a warehouse. It could be in a grocery store shelf. So, you know, the reality is that once it leaves here, you know, my job continues because, if I'm selling Peter Reinhardt oil, I want to make sure it's fresh, right? And so, you know, we have to think the process all the way through to the shelf and all the way through to the kitchen.
Yeah. And in some ways, you know, again, very different from wine, where sometimes longer in the bottle is good. It takes time for all those flavors to emerge. Where with oil, sooner is better.
So. That's right. Yeah. It's juice. I mean, think of it like juice.
Exactly. Well, this has been illuminating and, you know, exciting. And again, I want to remind everyone who's listening or watching that it doesn't have to be vicarious for you. You should contact Lisa at Corto. Or is it through the website? Best way to reach them is through the website.
If you go to the website, so it's Corto, CORTO-olive.com, scroll to the bottom and you can, it's right now, it's just open to kind of chefs and restaurants. And basically you can sign up we'll send you a kit and we'll set up a session for a one-on-one kind of tasting through and talking about, you know, having the experience of tasting and recognizing that fresh olive oil. And that's the biggest thing, is like taste your olive oil at every opportunity and kind of continue good and bad, right? Because we learn things from both of them. And it's really, you know, tasting first that flavor of the fruit, that it was harvested in the fall to kind of capture that flavor, and then that it's also been protected from light, air, and heat by kind of looking at how the oil is packaged and kind of thinking about where it came from and kind of how it was treated throughout that process.
David, you're in the cask room, and I know when I go to a winery and I walk through the cask room, I mean, part of the experience of taking a wine tour is the aromas and the aromasticity of what's it smell like? What are the aromas like when you're surrounded by casks of olive oil, or are they so protected that you're not getting any of that aroma?
Yeah, great question. So I don't get any aroma, and there's a good reason for that. So we all know now that light, heat, and air are the enemies of olive oil. And one of the ways we keep the air away is to inject nitrogen into the casks. And we used to bubble it through the oil to get it up into the head space, and it would protect and kind of encapsulate the oil. But what we found was that the cellar room smelled really good when we did that. And it occurred to us that when we were doing that, we were losing a lot of the valuable aromas that we, you know, worked so hard during the harvest to get into our oil. So we've changed our procedures now, and we're able to keep them all sealed and captured
in the oil. And not, a friend of mine calls that volatizing the aromasticity. You're giving it away for free, you know. And
that's right.
It's great when you're walking through, but how many of your customers are going to get to walk through the cask room like that?
Right.
I just wanted to ask, David, do you have the packaging handy just to kind of show?
Oh yeah, I do.
You know how the oil comes to the kitchen?
Because how do you package it is a big question.
This is something else that we don't talk about a lot. Is, you know, we now know light, heat, and air are the enemies of fresh oil, right? And the reality, and there are numerous shelf life studies that show this, the best package actually to keep fresh products fresh, not just oils, but juices, wines even, is actually bag and box. Because really? Bag and box does exactly what we do here in the cellar. Light can't penetrate. It has a bag that collapses as you dispense it, so air never hits the product. Uh-huh. And the cardboard can actually act as an insulator as well. So
yeah,
it is a only way I would, if I'm trying to sell Peter Reinhardt fresh oil, it's the only way I'm going to give it to you.
Well, now that, so what about people who want to get it? Is it sold only to the industry now? Is it food service, or is it consumer? Is it a consumer product, or, you know, how widespread is it?
Go ahead, Lisa.
You have a delay, so I wasn't sure. So Debbie, continue on. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, our bread and butter is food service. We are a chef driven company. We sell to chefs. We work with chefs. That's what we do. But we have made our oils available in on our website. So, you know, in smaller packages for everybody, you can just go to the website and buy there.
When the room was filled up with the nitrogen released aromas, what was that like? What was that? I mean, I got my hit off of smelling from the cup. Was it just like that magnified, or what?
Yeah, you know, one of the best ways to know the quality of an oil that's coming out is the smell when the olives are being crushed, right? Uh-huh. That releases a lot of aromas.
Yeah.
That smell is what we're trying to get to you, right? So we want to make sure we can smell that in the cup.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The smellers smelled like that.
so that bouquet is coming to you, you know, in the box of bag and in your little cup when you use it. And a lot to take with us now for those of you, again, hopefully from what we talked about already, should change the way you perceive the oils that you're using and what you should be looking for. And maybe over the next couple of years, as the education process sort of unfolds, for the general consumer public, the people are going to demand this, and they're going to start to get as snobby about olive oil as they do about wine, and you know, and that would be a good thing because
all just, you know, take a rest. Yeah.
People are in the Lodi area. Do you do tours or anything like that at the mill?
You know, we're not really open to the public, but we do tours for chefs if they contact us. Again, probably the website, or reach out to one of your local reps.
No, and you don't have a tasting open to the public. Like Peter. All right. Well, we definitely want to come out there. I want to get our whole Pizza Quest crew to come out with cameras and everything and really, you know, dive into it with you and take an olive oil bath with you. But, Lisa and David, thank you so much for sharing all this knowledge and for all the work that you're doing to help elevate not only this sector of the industry, but to bring great flavor, you know, to the populace. And we look forward to growing.
Always fun to chat with you, and thank you so much, you know, for inviting us on. This is our pleasure. Really, it's an honor.
Well, we look forward to seeing you. And of course, probably we'll see you when the next Pizza Expo happens, when we actually can do a live one and not just a virtual one. Who knows when all that will happen. But until then, at least, you know, we have these memories to share and these aromas and flavors. So thank you again. And keep up the great work. And we'll see you, you know, down the road for sure. And all of you, thank you for joining us. And don't forget to check out the Cordo website. You can see all these visuals. You can send for, you know, arrange with Lisa to get a real tasting and just keep coming back here to Pizza Quest. We have a lot more to share with you over the next few months. Thanks. Bye-bye. Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Thanks for listening.